The Bitcoin network itself and the personal owning of Bitcoin is an act of peaceful rebellion against the fiat money system. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Thank you so much for joining me. A happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I hope you guys had a wonderful little vacation. I have got a short but sweet article today. This one is by Dr. Wolf von Lahr, which we've actually been chatting. We want to get together. I'm not sure if we'll do an episode or something, but he is actually the CEO of Students for Liberty, and he is apparently pretty hardcore Bitcoiner, has gone down the rabbit hole, and it's exciting to see the libertarian community continue to like slowly embrace more and more, and I think we have so many inroads still to build. You know, we only just now got Dave Smith to take a second look at it, I feel like. And I want people to, it's so important that the libertarian movement and just anybody who values liberty, whether they're Republicans, they're Democrats or libertarians, make them understand or help them to understand just how powerful of a tool this is. And, Dr. Wolf does a really good job in this piece of laying that out, you know, of, explaining some of the major points, in a succinct way. Why Bitcoin is the best shot for liberty we have. So before we get into it, let's take a quick second to thank our amazing sponsors. Bitcoin 2022. Guys, you can get 10% off your tickets. Don't forget to grab your tickets. The sooner the better, the sooner the cheaper. And you want to save as many sats as possible. 10% off with Guy Swan. Buy your Bitcoin with Swan Bitcoin, auto DCA like me. Well, you could smash buy. I've been buying the dip. I've bought twice actually during this little dip, at swanbitcoin.com/guy. Keep that shit safe on your Bitbox. And you can get 5% off your Bitbox with code guy. Go to guyswan.com/bitbox. And of course, the other way to stack sats is just get sats back on everything you do with Fold. guyswan.com/fold has a 20% discount. That is hard to beat. And thank you to all of our amazing sponsors. All right. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled, Bitcoin is the single best shot at achieving liberty in our lifetime. By Dr. Wolf von Lahr. How do Bitcoin's properties present the best opportunity to seize liberty humanity has ever seen? What do you see when you switch on the TV or scroll through your newsfeed on your preferred social media platform? You see a failed war ended after 20 years, hundreds of thousands of people dead, billions of dollars squandered, and the same illiberal regime in charge as before. You also see inequality, rising prices and protests, and you see pushbacks for mandates. Bitcoiners regularly reply to all the troubles in the world by saying that Bitcoin fixes this. Hyperbole? No. Bitcoin is the only realistic pathway to the libertarian bon mot, our witty remark of fix the money, fix the world. Indeed, Bitcoin is the best shot libertarians have to shrink the size of government, fight inflation, curtail the debt from inflation, starve the military-industrial complex, and to avoid an ever-increasing scope for government. How does Bitcoin achieve this? Bitcoin is a savings technology that is nascent money. Money historically has three functions. It must serve as a store of value, a medium of exchange, and a unit of account. Bitcoin, despite its volatility, is certainly a store of value, but is thus far less prevalent as a medium of exchange or unit of account. However, Bitcoin has only been around for 12 years, and its rate of adoption is already growing faster than the internet's did. Money is the ultimate network good, which means that its value and usability increases with every user joining, and every user has the incentive to encourage others to take up Bitcoin, since it benefits them directly. As a result, within a short amount of time, Bitcoin has emerged from being a somewhat esoteric toy for cypherpunks to being adopted by financial institutions and the country of El Salvador, as well as becoming the savings technology for tens of millions of people around the world. Bitcoin's current user base is estimated to be around 120 million. This is absolutely remarkable. It does not matter why people use Bitcoin. It might be because it is cheaper and faster than traditional cross-border payments. It might be because it is collapsing upward and growing in value by around 200% annually. It might be because some people speculate on it. Or it might be because it saves lives and allows people to escape some of the worst environments possible. An example of this can be seen in some great articles written by Alex Gladstein, Chief Strategy Officer at the Human Rights Foundation, on Bitcoin usage in Afghanistan, Cuba, or Palestine. Bitcoin already empowers millions, and not just the rich elites with existing access to banks, stock markets, and other financial technologies. Bitcoin empowers the billions of people who are unbanked and promises a future that takes control of money away from the government. Bitcoin appeals to millions of people, and every person joining the Bitcoin network will have the incentive to attract more users. Bitcoin presents hope for millions and presents a viable plan B to holding fiat money, which melts in your hands due to the irresponsibility of monetary central planners. Right now, the most important reason why the government can grow beyond its mandate, beyond its income through taxation, is through the power of the government to print and force everyone to use their ever-value-losing money. In just the last 24 months, the U.S. Federal Reserve has printed 40% of all dollars in existence. Naturally, this has translated into huge levels of inequality, since the people close to the government's trough, such as banks, benefit from the higher purchasing power compared to the people at the bottom of the food chain, like fixed-income recipients, students, etc., who only see prices rise with diminishing real purchasing power. This is known as the Cantillon effect. The Federal Reserve Board is directly monetizing the debt that the government takes on, and the Fed provides infinite demand for government debt, which would not be able to grow at the astonishing pace it does without the power of the printing press to buy all of it up. The Bitcoin network itself and the personal owning of Bitcoin is an act of peaceful rebellion against the fiat money system. Every day when someone buys Bitcoin, it moves money away from the fiat system and puts it into a store of value. It is put into a system that cannot be inflated. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin issued. Bitcoin has been tested, Bitcoin has been attacked, and the protocol has remained robust against 12 years of adversaries trying to undermine it. Many of Bitcoin's detractors fundamentally don't understand Bitcoin's value proposition, and it makes sense that they don't. We have not seen a new type of money emerge in over 5 millennia. Moreover, Bitcoin's roots lie in more atypical fields, such as Austrian economics, game theory, cryptography, and economic history. Thus, the frameworks through which most economists and pundits analyze Bitcoin are highly inadequate. Another new aspect is that Bitcoin gives its users absolute control over their money. They can decide when to send money, how much, and how much they pay for a transaction. Nobody needs to be asked if you can send money to a nonprofit organization 6,000 miles away, and nobody needs to confirm if you can send remittances to your family in other countries. No agency or bank can prevent this. Bitcoin allows you to become your own bank. This is incredibly empowering, and such technology has not existed before. And that will close our short but great little piece by Dr. Wolf von Lahr. Let's take a quick break right here and hit our sponsor, and we'll jump back into Guy's take on this piece. Okay, guys, Bitcoin 2022 is going to be lit. I cannot imagine how many people are going to be there. It was truly something to behold last year. 2021 was genuinely incredible. I would have been kicking myself to have missed it. And, you know, you don't want to be that person this coming year. If you can make it, please come out, hang out. I want to meet as many of you as you can every time I go to these conferences. And I'm usually in Florida for a little bit longer than I am at other conferences. So hopefully there's a good opportunity to do that. Luckily, you guys who have not gotten tickets yet can get 10% off with code GUYSWAN. Swan has two N's. Don't forget it. Or you can go through my link at guyswan.com/2022. It'll take you straight to where you can grab your tickets, whether you're getting the tickets for the music festival, the all access to the conference, or the art gallery, the Lightning Gaming space, all the crazy stuff. Or if you want to hang out with the whales and get a whale pass. Paris Hilton and Ron Paul were there last year, actually. And that's, you know, that's a testament to the broad appeal of Bitcoin. Never would have thought that the values and interests of Ron Paul and Paris Hilton would have landed them at the same party. But anyway, you get 10% off that and any of the stuff you want to do or attend at Bitcoin 2022 with code GUYSWAN. All right, let's jump into Guy's take. And just because this is such a topic that is so true or at the core of what Bitcoin is. And I think a lot of people just misunderstand how powerful of a tool it is. And it's not just about being able to hold your own keys. Like, that is a core principle of financial independence, of being independent in the individual sense. But it's funny what Bitcoin as a network, as a system does to ensure the freedom of the collective, in a sense, at the exact same time. Like, not only does it enable individual control, but it enables the group to defend themselves against monetary debasement, against monetary fraud. That's what we're talking about. That's what debasement is. That is the only legitimate way to describe printing trillions of dollars out of thin air to fund one person's deficit, one group's particular deficit, at the cost of everyone else. That is what we have done. And of course, it has led to trillions of dollars of corruption building up around it. Lobbying, subsidies, everybody ignoring the customer, ignoring the consumer, the U.S. consumer, as far as like caring about having good support for the people who use their product, for caring about building a robust and long-term solution to a problem, good products for the consumer. Caring about establishing long-term relationships with a consumer rather than, I mean, we literally have the opposite. Like, tons of different services and companies actually punish the people who have been with them the longest. Like, who is paying the most for cable and internet? When you look at those systems and the plans that they lay out, they're in a constant volatile rush to just catch the whims of the people who just switch services every year. Because you get a deal, you get like $80 a month for the first 12 months, and then suddenly it's like $150, $160, and then they charge you to try to even leave the service. You don't get a reward for being there longer, you get punished. And I use this as an example, actually, because I worked in that industry. Like, I've repaired internet and, you know, infrastructure lines and like that sort of thing as a job for quite a while, and I saw it all the time. There were actually times like when I was like going, you know, just to customers' houses and installing cable and internet and stuff, where I would just every year I would install or break down the setup for the same person, because they were just chasing the deals. They were just chasing the the first 6 months free of HBO or the first 12 months at half the price or whatever it was, and they would just switch over to the other service. Why has this happened? How has this happened? We don't stop and think about in a free market, the consumer is the only source of capital. They are the only ones to please. They are the only ones to appeal to. How has so much of major business ignored them? Because 40% of the freaking economy is funneled through a giant machine of theft and counterfeiting. If near half of the economy is just completely created, is just confiscated and redistributed out of thin air by banks and governments, then who are the customers? Banks and governments. They are the ones to appeal to. The politicians are the ones to lobby to, because that's how you get a contract. They are the customer. They have replaced us. And what do you know? They don't really care about the quality of service we receive. They do care about their expensive dinners, about their speaking fees, about their private jets, about their insider trading. It's amazing that the people who clamor for more government control see everyone as evil and greedy, and in the process of trying to combat that, they create the most efficient and perfect incentive structure to reward being selfish and greedy. And the base layer source of that corruption, of that giant lobbying center of the world, of that subsidy-driving, corruption-inducing machine, is the fact that money costs them nothing. It doesn't even cost them in people getting pissed off about taxes, because it's completely hidden. Every single dollar of government deficit is printed out of thin air. It cannot exist unless it is being taxed from the people if you are talking about a sound monetary system. Think about it. There is zero way that a government can spend Bitcoin, can send Bitcoin to someone, to a contractor, to someone for a subsidy, to a lobbyist, whoever it is. They cannot send Bitcoin that doesn't exist, that they don't have, which means that the only option for them is to tax it. And if it is incredibly easy, or at least relatively easy, in the context of our current system and structure and banking and finances and all that stuff, if it is far easier to protect your money, to hide your money, or to be able to leave the country with your money without confiscation, then governments become service providers that have to appeal to the people, that have to appeal to their customers. But understand, that is the only way to secure it. It is individual defense, the ability to defend against violence at scale, that disables the tool of violence, of taxation, as the funding mechanism. Even if that taxation is still kind of ceremonially a part of the system, the lower the barrier for someone to exit with what they own, with their property, the more the concept, or the more the action of taxing people appears much more relevant, or much more akin to rent as opposed to theft. Now, it's not any kind of a clean, like, on and off switch. It's a very difficult, complex, and multifaceted system. But the ability to defend oneself and one's capital that they produce in the world, the value that you own and produce in this world, the ability to defend that against confiscation or debasement, which are the same thing, just two different versions of it, is the ability to defend your liberty. And the very nature of Bitcoin, both in the way that it secures its monetary properties and policy without any central party, without the ability to manipulate or corrupt it, but then at the exact same time securing individual value behind cryptography, behind the public-private key system, and the incredible asymmetric dynamic of cost of defense versus the cost of attack, the shift in that Bitcoin represents is not small. Like, it's a massive step forward in the context of all monetary alternatives. It's incredible that we have this at our disposal. But possibly the easiest way to identify with that and begin to see the pieces of the puzzle as to why that's such a powerful dynamic shift is to look at it on the individual level, is to look at individual stories. And that's why, Dr. Wolf says in this piece, mentions in this piece, the articles by Alex Gladstein, and he actually links to them, to the ones for Afghanistan, Cuba, or Palestine. I will have the links actually in the show notes. I'll just link to all of Gladstein's pieces. I think he's got like 5 or 6 maybe in that series now that we've done on the show. Maybe even more. I don't know. I feel like I've been doing that every 2 or 3 weeks now. And he has just been absolutely killing it with kind of the boots on the ground stories of how Bitcoin is securing and defending people's liberty all over the world. And in the places where it's hardest to do that, where is there is the least hope of having that liberty and financial sovereignty anywhere in the world. And Bitcoin is providing an out for these people. It's really amazing. The one in Afghanistan, it still gets me that there were two checkpoints, I think, two major checkpoints, because travel has been incredibly restricted. I cannot remember the guy's name, but one of the stories that's followed in that piece, he likens Bitcoin, because they can't even move capital in and out of the country. He analogized Bitcoin as a third checkpoint, as a checkpoint that never closes, that's always open, where you can move capital in and out, and you still have this access, this communication with the rest of the world, whereas basically everything else, all the other economic activity, is cut off. And I just kind of love that analogy, that it's this alternative pipe, it's this economic connection to the entire world that cannot be shut down fully. There's nothing that can be done to truly stop the communication, because communication is so easy and Bitcoin is nothing but information. And when you free information and then you manage to establish real value, when you create money as a purely informational tool, you have made it impossible to stop value. And that is a unbelievably potent combination. And we are only beginning to see a very tiny piece of what that change could actually do, what that actually means in the context of the whole world. We're still witnessing the incredible changes that the internet and the very nature of freeing information and allowing independent communication, peer-to-peer communication, without a centralized authority, without a algorithm telling them exactly what to see and what to hear, and just splitting that, those alternatives or those avenues into so many different aspects into so many different paths, that there is no single center for the control of information. We are only now really witnessing the impact of that, of just the openness of information and what changes and how quickly those changes take place in society when people can freely communicate, when there's no real monopoly on the source of information. Now, there's always centralization. There's always elements of control, and we're seeing that start to rebirth in kind of the second stage, this re-centralization of the internet, where we're basically the front page or the window through which we view the internet, or quote-unquote surf, is now social media. So the amount of control that things like Instagram and Facebook and Google and Twitter and all of these services have is very high, but it is neither the degree of control nor exactly the kind of control that was available to centralized institutions, to major like media powers and governments before the internet, before social media. Like, that control is far harder. I mean, they can't even deal with bots. The idea that they can fully shut down information from traveling, it's just not an easy task. It's a far more daunting and difficult task than when you owned, you know, or influenced and had a major hand in the three major channels on TV, you know, back in the 80s. It was so much easier to control the narrative and control what people saw and consumed in the world because it was all passive. It's a totally passive medium. You just project out what you want them to think, and most people are going to end up thinking that. But when the consumption of that media, when the building of that narrative becomes an active thing that people respond to, that people interact with, that creates threads and arguments and memes, this is a much different beast to try to control. And remember, we're only talking about information. We're just talking about how people source information, build communities, and develop narratives about the world around them. That has changed drastically, but there is still a very key, critical component that did not have that free flow, that did not have that open access and the breadth of alternatives that the internet gave to information, and that was value. And this is a problem of information. One of the reasons real information is so hard to come by and misinformation is such a problem is because there's no skin in the game, because the control of the value is still so imperative for the honesty of the information. If there are no economic consequences to the government being wrong about something that they spent $1 trillion on, well, then there's no way to stop that misallocation. There's no skin in the game cost for that. Being wrong is meaningless as long as they hold the right position of power, of control. And that's not a good world to live in. Those are not good incentives to progress into the future on. That is a path to destruction. Lies are lies. Being incorrect is meaningful. The reason those things are even the very concepts of them are because they mean something in the world. Because they have consequences. And the greatest incentive to keep that in check is to have to pay the real cost. It is the economic consequence. And when you have a system where someone can print trillions of dollars out of thin air, you're talking about the complete elimination of the economic consequence of the person who has the money printer from ever having skin in the game about their decisions, about their lies, about being incorrect. It doesn't even have to be malicious, even though it incentivizes maliciousness, even though it incentivizes corruption. The consequences are the same when it fails to punish incompetence, when stupidity can simply keep doing the same thing over and over because there's no real economic cost for the people who are making the decisions. It produces the same results either way. Because there's no feedback mechanism to punish, to hold them accountable for the economic cost of their decisions. And it is all because they manipulate the money to just confiscate the purchasing power to create these, to do these things. It's just so hard to articulate how shockingly massive that misallocation of resources and incentives truly is, like what the scale of the damage that this imbalance causes. Yet Bitcoin is a systemic solution to the imbalance, to the ability to print money at all. Imagine how many more people in the country would actually be fiscally conservative if they knew that they had to be directly taxed for every single plan the government wanted to implement. There is truly this illusion that everything the government does is totally free. They could just invent money and then we have all of these great new things and wealth is just invented. That there's no cost for this. Obviously there is a cost. We see the inequality grow. We see the poverty grow. We see the damage to the economy. We see the decades-long stagnation that the U.S. economy has gone through and the constant cycles of bailouts and crashes that we've experienced and the horrible, massive debt bubble that we are in. Like, anybody who even tries to look at the situation objectively sees the damage. That's the damage. Those are the results of this system. And Dr. Wolf sums up this problem in one sentence very, very well. Like, this is the best way to sum it up. Right now, the most important reason why the government can grow beyond its mandate, beyond its income through taxation, is through the power of the government to print and force everyone to use their ever-value-losing money. And Bitcoin is a tool that defends against this both in the collective sense and the individual sense. Individually through the ability for the user to have greater control and optionality with their own finances, the ability to move money independently of any of the state-controlled financial systems, therefore eliminating capital controls as a vector for trapping and enslaving citizens. But also, like I said, in the collective sense, the inability to debase the very currency that is within that system. It is its own infrastructure to move capital, as well as its own monetary policy to defend and immunize against any sort of debasement or central issuance. That is the ultimate tool of defense. You know, we talk about the Second Amendment, and the people who understand the value of the Second Amendment and an armed population, that it is necessary to make the government wary about taking totalitarian control of its citizens. Independent, sound money is a greater tool of defense for the individual and the collective than the Second Amendment, hands down. Think about it. The reason that the Second Amendment, that an armed population is a defense against the government, is because the government's entire goal is to confiscate resources from the citizens for its desired ends, for its goals. The only reason the government is consequential whatsoever is because it commands individuals' resources. If it cannot command resources, if it cannot hire guns, if it cannot build ships, if it cannot pay for any of the things that it wants to pay for, it is inconsequential. It doesn't have any power. All of the political power comes from the ability to command resources. And an armed population, the Second Amendment, is a defensive tool to make totalitarian governments, to make people who seek unbridled power over others, to be worried, to be concerned about pissing those people off too much. Because the consequences of going too far with an armed population are worse than the consequences of going too far with an unarmed population. The exact same dynamic stands if you're robbing a gas station with an armed cashier or an unarmed cashier, or you're robbing a country. Just ask King George III. But remember, it's about the ability to command the resources. The gun, the armed population, is just that which will find a threshold for when they will stand between the government and the resources. If that government doesn't actually have to take the resources from them, but that they have systemic default control of all of the resources without needing to do anything, what good does having an armed population do you? They went right around all your guns and your attempts to protect and defend your life, and they've just snatched it out from under you. They've modified the nature of the money itself, of the resources, of the value that you own, and locked it within a system that they totally control, and they can tell you what you can and can't do with it, and fraudulently produced it by the trillions. They made the Second Amendment obsolete by commanding all of the resources by default, so that you standing between them is irrelevant. That is why I argue that sound, independent money that is immune from government control is far more important than having an armed population. Or at least it's a prerequisite. They go very hand in hand. One isn't really that effective without the other. So I'm appealing to all the Second Amendment people today that if you believe an armed population is a useful tool for liberty, is an important way to defend against tyranny, having that without an independent sound money, without a way to hold value that isn't directly and totally controllable and confiscatable by the government, is useless. or at least so neutered in its effectiveness, as to be largely irrelevant. Think about it. If the government can print trillions and trillions of dollars that you have in and basically debase your savings, then they have the ability to just hire more guns than you have. And it just seems like something that's missed in the conversation. And I guess that's really just kind of by its nature or where it lies in the scope of what the normal person is aware of or knowledgeable about. You know, Dr. Wolf actually says, he's got another quote in this piece, kind of about why Bitcoin is so hard to understand. He says, Bitcoin's roots lie in more atypical fields, such as Austrian economics, game theory, cryptography, and economic history. Thus, the frameworks through which most economists and pundits analyze Bitcoin are highly inadequate. And that's true. You know, there's very little common knowledge about Austrian economic fundamentals, about game theory. Cryptography might as well just be magic to 99.9% of the population. And economic history is 100%. I mean, if you don't understand Austrian economics, you're not going to be able to make sense of economic history, and you're just going to be fed the government propaganda that the government has saved us from all of the chaos of the free market throughout all of history. And even though the second the government did everything they could to stop the Great Depression, it managed to make it persist for 11 years. Somehow that means the government saved us from it. The amount of twisting that you have to do for the kind of mainstream view of economic history to make sense is really pretty extraordinary in some contexts. Not to mention the incredible amount of rich monetary and central banking history of the United States that is basically ignored. Or simply not talked about because it's pretty inconvenient for the mainstream ideas of economics and monetary policy. And what government would want to reinforce that, to make that very clear, the incredible consequences and damage that can be done through manipulation of money? I mean, would we expect Walmart to directly fund and teach people about where their products killed their customers, or where they caused other problems, or where they constantly broke or failed to do what they were trying to do? Then why would we not expect this to apply to the government? And you know, I think that's part of the reason why when people discover Bitcoin and kind of start going down the rabbit hole, what they're doing is they're learning an alternative view of history. They're learning something, some pieces of the world, of how major systems that define our world and how they work, that it truly changes what things mean. You know, it alters your worldview. That's why it feels like going down a rabbit hole, because even some of the basics of Austrian economics will make you look at everything differently. You'll see right through all of the nonsense political platitudes that are repeated over and over again, and how, I mean, like just recently, Senator Warren or whatever, talking about how big turkey corporations are evil and they're unfairly raising the price of turkeys while to defend their record profits and stock market valuations, when literally both of these things are direct consequences of the monetary policy. It doesn't take a very deep understanding. It's very basics of Austrian economic theory to look at that and see through the bullshit. And that education alone is so powerful. And the fact that Bitcoin is exposing this, is bringing this into the light and kind of making Austrian economics cool, you know, was really insane. When I first stumbled upon Austrian economics and libertarianism, it was depressing because Austrian econ had been trying to make sense of the world for people and explaining and predicting. They predicted the Great Depression. They predicted the bubble, the boom and the bust cycle in the 20s. Like, so much of Austrian economics makes the consequences of these government policies and the monetary manipulation really simple. Like, it's not like you can predict it to the day. The time frames are always very complex because you're dealing about a very complex system. But the principles hold true, and there's basically just, it's 11th grade math, you know? It's what Greg Foss says. And that's why Ron Paul is on the congressional floor talking about the fact that we're about to send ourselves into a giant housing boom and bust cycle in like 2001. But that hopelessness of feeling like we were shouting into the dark, or that, you know, nobody is listening, has fundamentally changed. And I think it's changed because of Bitcoin. Like, there was an article today or yesterday or something. Was it the 26th? So it was today on entrepreneur.com. And it's titled, I haven't actually read the whole thing yet. It's pretty short. I'll probably hit it on the way to my in-laws today. But it says, why every entrepreneur should study the Austrian School of Economics. I just, you know, going back 10 years when I was first stumbling upon this stuff, or I guess maybe 12 years somewhere. How old am I? College? So, wow, maybe 15 years ago now. Good Lord. When I was first stumbling upon this, like, that would seem insane. That it would be that much in the in kind of the collective mind, in the general mainstream or the culture, that you would see just open articles about something like that. Like, Austrian economics was a niche school like no other. And, you know, you could argue that inflation and, like, the crazy fiscal policy and everything that's been going on, and the chaos of the boom and bust cycle, and the constant bailouts and all of this stuff, has undoubtedly also attributed to the rise of Austrian School of Economics. But I think Bitcoin is such a totem of proof. Basically, this thing that is standing there and showing the difference. You know, it's the control group when it comes to monetary policy. It's the experiment we never had before. It's the example of what it looks like in practice, secured as an alternative system that disproves the mainstream lies. And the longer it just keeps working, the more obvious Bitcoin's contradiction becomes. You know, I've probably used this analogy before on the show, but I can think of it like Bitcoin is to the Keynesian economist as dinosaur bones are to the creationist. Or maybe, you know, Bitcoin is to Keynesian economist as satellites in orbit are to flat earthers. It is a technology that is real and right in front of us, disproving the lies that Keynesians say about sound money. Every single year that the Bitcoin economy does not collapse in a complete lack of innovation and lack of economic activity, despite its value doubling, is absolute proof that the deflationary spiral of an economic system, or a sound monetary system, that nobody will ever do anything, there'll be no innovation, and the economy will collapse, is stupid, is just wrong. Bitcoin has experienced the greatest price deflation of a monetary good in the world over the last 12 years. Why has the economy not collapsed? Why does Bitcoin's ecosystem continue to thrive and innovate? It is literally claimed that that is impossible by Keynesian economists. And every year that the Bitcoin space doesn't just implode under its own awful deflationary weight, is just like another 100 satellites launched into the sky, sending down live video feed as they orbit the Earth, while flat earthers plug their ears and squeal about how it's all a giant conspiracy. And then we get the great opportunity to call them out on social media and make them look stupid. The memes are real, man. It is a meme war. Keep blowing up those posts. Make sure that the replies that people see are the ones that make it obvious how ridiculous that stuff is. And the fact that we can see through it, the fact that a basic understanding of Austrian economics and of Bitcoin game theory and, you know, economic history, these things that we dig into just out of the excitement that we have around Bitcoin, that can't be discounted. You know, just the fact, like, not only is Bitcoin such a powerful tool for individual defense, for an independent systemic defense against manipulated and corrupted monetary policy, like, it has so many different aspects, but then at the same time, it incentivizes an education in these important concepts that you just don't get anywhere else. And that is amazing. That's really amazing that the rabbit hole is such an exciting experience, and it teaches you so much about the world and just puts a fresh light on so many problems in the world. And suddenly you realize there is a solution. There is a way out of this. There is something that affects so many of our fundamental, like our largest problems in society, and it can be fixed. Fix the money, fix the world. There is a serious seed of truth in that meme. And that should do it for today. Thank you guys for listening. A huge thank you to Dr. Wolf von Lahr for this piece. Short and sweet, but you know, hits so much. It's hard not to. I read the title and I was like, damn. I got a guy's take on this. Bitcoin's the single best shot at achieving liberty in our lifetime. Amen, man. It really is. And how lucky we are. In the spirit of Thanksgiving, how lucky we are to have this. How thankful that we have this community, that we have this tool to help defend ourselves, to build a better life, to save for the future, to immunize, to allow us to step outside of the corruption of the monetary system, and for it to stand as this totem to show the absurdity of the legacy system and expose the problems that they are causing, and allow us this incentive to educate ourselves about things that we would never have otherwise been educated about. What an amazing thing to be thankful for and to have at our disposal in our generation, and how freaking lucky are we. It really is just an amazing thing. So thank you to Dr. Wolf for this short little piece on Bitcoin Magazine. Thank you to Bitcoin Magazine. Oh, and also don't forget to get your Bitcoin 2022 tickets. Whether you want to be crazy with the whale pass and get to see all the celebrities and talk to all the people, or you want to hang out with the plebs like me, who get the cheap tickets, 10% off with guyswan.com/2022. That is for all the audionauts. Don't forget discounts. Discounts are critical. Don't leave that money on the table. Don't spend more sats than you need to. And a thank you to our other amazing sponsors, Swan Bitcoin, the Bitbox O2 hardware wallet, and Fold. These guys just have the best products in the space, and you can check them all out at guyswan.com. And of course, I got a link in the show notes. Thank you all for listening, for joining me. Don't forget to subscribe. We've got some fun stuff coming. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Hope you guys have an awesome weekend. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. You have been listening to Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.